Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar, the first of the new year. We're looking forward to 2023, sort of, and we hope you will stay with us for 12 months. I am Shoshana Bryant, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. We have a very large audience today. I know I think I say that every week, but this week it's actually true. Maybe we were some people's New Year's resolution. So I'm going to introduce the JPC and our work once again. If you've heard it before, hear it again, and then our speaker. We are a 501c3 organization founded in 1985, providing analysis of foreign and domestic policy by leading scholars and academics. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them, and against anyone who would deny the right of the Jewish people to pray at Judaism's holiest place. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. You can read our publication on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. Starting tomorrow, you can read the new winter issue of In Focus magazine there, entitled An Agenda for the New Congress. So assuming that we get a new Congress, you can see what we think their agenda should look like. You can find videos of our previous webinars there, lots of good information and lots of enlightening speakers. Speaking of enlightening speakers, today we are thrilled to have Jonathan Shanzer as our guest, Senior Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Jonathan is also on the financial, on the economic and financial power leadership team, because his background is in terrorism finance, where he worked at the Department of the Treasury. He played an integral role in the designation of numerous foreign terrorist financiers. He spent time at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the Middle East Forum. And he sat in my chair here at the Jewish Policy Center. And I hope I'm living up to the standard you set, Jonathan. You can let me know. Privately, please. He is the author of a terrific book called Gaza 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War. You can read the review in the winter 2022 issue of In Focus Quarterly. Actually read the review and then buy the book. It is nominally about the Hamas rocket war last year, but it's also about the regional implications of Iranian policy, coupled with Iranian money and the cowardly behavior of the rest of the world when it comes to Israel defending itself or doing the things that normal countries do. And that is a hint about the world's phony outrage over Jews praying at the Temple Mount. When you get into the policy, it's all the same policy. His previous books have made important contributions to the field of Middle East politics and security as well. One was called State of Failure, Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Unmaking of the Palestinian State. This is what we call an evergreen book. Evergreen, ever useful, ever pertinent. Another is Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine. Same thing, never outdated. And the third is Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliate Groups, and the Next Generation of Terror. Probably a good idea to understand that one. Jonathan has written hundreds of articles on the Middle East, along with more than a dozen monographs. He testifies before Congress. He's widely traveled in the Middle East and sought after by media. He has appeared everywhere you think he should, everywhere you think he would, so I'm not gonna list them all. His PhD is from King's College in London, where he wrote his dissertation on US Congress and its effort to combat terrorism. Jonathan, our first question will be, how are we doing? Today, he is really going to talk about Jordan, the Kingdom of Jordan, nominally an ally of the United States, nominally at peace with Israel. Question is it both? Is it neither? Is it either? Jonathan Shanzer, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Shoshana. Great to be with you. Great to be with everybody today. My most recent piece of research directly deal with the question of Jordan and its role in the U.S. alliance and its peace with Israel. I think the point of departure for us today is the signing of the Abraham Accords in 2020. This was, of course, a groundbreaking event. We saw a remarkable decision undertaken by the UAE and Bahrain, and then later Sudan and Morocco, to bury the hatchet with Israel. And in the wake of that, a rare sense of optimism washed over the Middle East. This is, of course, not something that we say easily. Optimism in the Middle East are words that don't often go together. But what we began to think about was a new region, a new structure. And as we began to watch some of these things unfold, in particular, the warm peace exhibited by the UAE and Bahrain, it dawned on me that the previous warm peace that Israel enjoyed, this arrangement that it had with Jordan dating back to 1994, when Jordan made its peace with Israel, things had turned decidedly cold. And it was not something that happened overnight. I think we can say that with certainty now that really over the last 6 to 10 years, we've watched the deterioration of this peace. It was something that was alarming to me. So I traveled to Jordan in September, had an opportunity to chat with a number of senior officials over there, stakeholders and journalists and former officials. And the more I talked to people, the more I realized that things were not well. Now, let me just say here that I don't believe that everything is about to collapse. I don't believe that Jordan has turned into an enemy of Israel. And I don't believe that it is defected from the American alliance. I think that Jordan still sees America as its most crucial ally, I think as evidenced by a new 7-year memorandum of understanding that essentially secures Jordan a significant amount of cash and also military assistance. I also see that the relationship between Israel and Jordan is still strong where it matters. In other words, there's intelligence cooperation, there's military cooperation, there's gas, there's water. There's a range of other things that I think are serving both countries well. But the problem is, quite frankly, the Jordanian rhetoric. The rhetoric does not reflect the reality here that Jordan needs Israel. It needs the United States, which has been rewarding Jordan for its relationship with Israel. This has been the quid pro quo dating back to 1994. And as we look at the unraveling of this relationship, or at least the ugly airing of grievances, I don't think it portends well for U.S. Interests in the region. It certainly doesn't portend well for Israel or Jordan. And so that is why I decided to dive into this topic. So let me first just address the regional changes themselves, because I think this is important that, you know, really probably beginning in 2011 with the Arab Spring, and then 2 years later with the 2013 Joint Plan of Action, the JPOA, that ill-fated interim nuclear deal that the Obama administration entered into with Iran, there was a sense of alarm among a lot of the Arab states that the U.S. was just going in the wrong direction, that it was supporting Islamists, that it was supporting Iran, that the policies were sort of a bizarro world, that it was going against every sort of logical instinct of American policy as defined over decades. The Arab world began to look to Israel, which was the only country that was standing up to Iran, the only country that was really trying to fight back against some of these Islamist movements in a direct way. I would say that the admiration that we saw from some of these Arab states has probably only grown in recent years as Israel has engaged in what we would describe as the war between wars, this quiet asymmetric campaign where Israel has been targeting Iranian assets nearly every night in places like Syria or in cyberspace or on the high seas. Amidst all of that, we've also seen Israeli advances over the last decade in technology and in intelligence and missile defense, desalinization, agriculture, I mean, cyber, you name it. And all of this, I think, gave a sense to the Arab world that, hey, first of all, we're not beating Israel on the battlefield. Second of all, look at all the wonderful things that Israel can provide. So perhaps maybe it's time that we start working with this regional power. And this is not to say that these countries didn't care about the Palestinian cause. I think these countries still do care about the Palestinian cause. They've just deprioritized the Palestinian cause as they see is fit for countries around the region that need something from their neighbor. And Jordan has not done this. Jordan, I mean, made its peace in 1994, but they have not gone in that same direction of deprioritizing the Palestinian cause. In fact, if anything, what we've seen is that they have underscored the importance of it more and more, and they are probably the most vociferous advocates for the Palestinian cause today. And I believe that that is probably one of the major sources of friction, maybe not the only one, but one of the major sources. Now, before we get to some of the friction itself, just to give a quick rehash, of course, Jordan was opposed to the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. Despite warnings by Israel, it joined with the other Arab countries in hostilities against Israel in 1967. And that's, of course, when Israel won Jerusalem from Jordan, as well as the West Bank, Judea and Samaria. But that doesn't mean that they were bitter enemies through and through. The Israelis helped to thwart Syrian aggression during the Black September crisis of the early 1970s. King Hussein, the former king of Jordan, even warned Israel of an impending Arab attack on the eve of the 1973 October Yom Kippur War. And in 1987, the two sides actually nearly reached an agreement that was scuttled only by the outbreak of the First Intifada. But after the Palestinians entered the Oslo Accords in 93, that was the last barrier. And basically, the Hashemite Kingdom determined that it was time to make its own peace. That peace was really, I think, held together by Yitzhak Rabin, the former prime minister of Israel, and King Hussein. There were moments of tension, like when the Mossad tried to assassinate Khaled Meshal, a senior Hamas official in 97. There was also that same year, that was the year that a Jordanian soldier opened fire on a group of Israeli students visiting the Island of Peace, as it was known, land that was leased to Israel as part of the 1994 agreement. But really, I would say that that you began to see the fault lines with the ascension of Abdullah, Hussein's son. He came to power in 1999. Shortly after that, we saw the outbreak of the Second Intifada. Jordan recalled its ambassador. Despite the fact that the United States was giving significant assistance to help keep the Hashemite Kingdom intact, and despite the fact that Israeli water and gas and defense coordination intelligence were helping to keep the Hashemite Kingdom together under the leadership of Abdullah, we began to see some real tensions. And I would say that we could go back maybe to 2016 or 2015. I mean, I remember there was a UNGA speech where King Abdullah got up and put the blame entirely on Israel for the lack of diplomatic process between Israel and the Palestinians. There was a moment where a Jordanian stabbed an Israeli security guard in 2017 in the embassy compound in Amman. And when the guard shot his attacker in self-defense, it prompted this full-blown crisis. And that happened right at around the same time that Israel had installed metal detectors on the Temple Mount after two Israeli policemen were shot and killed. The rhetoric really began to ratchet up during that time period, 2016, 2017. I think making matters worse was the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu, then prime minister, now prime minister, had a rather terrible relationship with the king. It was widely reported that the two of them did not get along very well, and that, in fact, it was Yossi Cohen, the former head of the Mossad, that did most of the interaction with King Abdullah, that he was the one that had to deal with the monarch and not Bibi, because the two of them just simply could not be trusted to get along and to make arrangements in the same room. Then I think in 2020, it was really interesting just to compare the reactions of some of the other Arab states, like the UAE and Bahrain, versus Jordan, as the Israelis were considering the annexation of the West Bank, or parts of the West Bank. If you recall, there was sort of a quasi-offer on the table by the Trump administration. At least Bibi was flirting with it. He was talking about it rather openly. And the Jordanians were absolutely vitriolic, talking about a red line that would have catastrophic impact on their relationship. And it was all stick, no carrot, so to speak. And then you have on the other side, you've got the UAE, which was looking at this, and they said, okay, Israel, we would prefer you not to do this. And as an inducement for you not to do it, we are going to offer you peace. And that was essentially the quid pro quo that led to the Abraham Accords. And again, you can see the difference in the approaches of these governments. Jordan has, I think, reflexively jumped to confrontation, where some of these new partners have been looking for ways to perhaps nudge Israel in a direction that would be more acceptable for the Arab world. I would say that for me, though, the moment that was kind of that light bulb, and Shoshana mentioned this in her introduction of some of my work, was when I was writing the book, Gaza Conflict 2021. It was during that war, during which Hamas was raining down 3,500 or so rockets on Israel, that King Hussein and his government essentially blamed Israel for the entire conflict. The rhetoric was, in my mind, outrageous. The blame, again, entirely placed on Israel for the outbreak of this. The government accused the Israeli police and special forces of being barbaric during this conflict. They cited the reason for the conflict as, quote, violations against the mosque, Al-Aqsa Mosque, to attack worshipers. And Ayman al-Safadi, the foreign minister, continually slammed Israel at the Arab League, at the UN, in his own media, saying that Israel was playing with fire. Now, a year or so passed, and one might think that things would have gotten better. They, in fact, did not. During the most recent flare-up of tensions, it's almost as if you can schedule these sorts of tensions. Every Ramadan, you kind of know that they're going to break out. You can put it on your calendar that next Ramadan, we are likely to see a ratcheting up of tensions between Jordan and Israel. And this past summer was no different. And then in September, I found this one shocking as well. Abdullah got up before the UNGA, got up at Turtle Bay, and charged that Christianity in the holy city is under fire. In other words, blaming Israel for the poor treatment of Christians in the country. Of course, that, I think, ignores entirely the fact that Christians have more rights in Israel than they do in just about every other country, if not every country in the Middle East. So this is the sort of background on the tensions. And then, you know, just to sharpen the point here a little bit on the Abraham Accords, Jordan did not send representatives to that signing ceremony. Right. So this is a peace partner of Israel that refused to honor or recognize the agreement that was signed in 2020 on the White House lawn. And then in 2022, Amman sent, I think, an even tougher message in that it declined to participate in the Negev summit. This is, of course, the follow-up diplomatic structure that was created with the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States to help try to further peace and normalization in the region. And Jordan refused to do it as long as there was no Palestinian representative. So all of this, I think, you know, belies a troubling trend. And then I think there is the other interesting thing to watch here, which is, what does this message send to the UAE? Or to even Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia being a country that is not normalized with Israel, but is building better ties with Israel every week, every month. We hear about some sort of new small baby step toward this ultimate goal of normalization. These two countries are Jordan's most important patrons. They provide them with cash. They provide them with energy. And if Jordan is rejecting their overtures and this new arrangement that is slowly taking shape in the region, what does that mean for Jordan's longevity? What does it mean for Jordan's prospects? And I ask this in light of the fact that Jordan's economy is really not doing well. It has not been doing well. It perennially does not do well because it does not have natural resources. It's running out of water. It needs Israel for gas. It needs Israel for water. It needs Israel for security. It needs the United States for money. It needs the UAE for money. It needs the Saudis for money. And then on top of all of that, they've got massive security problems, right? They are on the border with Syria, where a massive number of refugees have crossed over and are now living in Jordan, draining their resources every day, but also posing security challenges. They're on the border with Iraq, also not exactly Canada. And then on top of that, we see threats from Iranian militias, Shiite militias to the north in both of those territories. We see Iranian challenges in the Red Sea to the south. We have a Captagon problem, a drug problem, where Jordan has been a place where they have traditionally smuggled smuggled weapons and drugs through the country. Now we're seeing that Jordan has been a place where all of these things stay. Now, the question then becomes, why reject this new arrangement? Why reject this new regional structure that appears to be taking place, where things are moving in a more positive direction, where countries like the UAE and even Saudi Arabia are talking about prosperity and stability, and they're downplaying the Palestinian cause? And I think there, you know, and we can start to wrap up here, but it really does track right back to the Palestinian cause itself. Jordan is at least 50% Palestinian, if not 75 or 80 or 85% Palestinian. We're not going to get a clear answer from this. Jordanian officials will quietly cede that it could be up to 50%, but I believe it's quite a bit more than that at this point. And the population just simply does not want to see normalization as it is unfolding, for example, with the UAE or Bahrain. This is just not something that the Palestinian population of Jordan is willing to countenance. When I was in Jordan in September, I was shocked to see the preponderance of bumper stickers with Saddam Hussein's likeness on it on the highway. And I asked a Jordanian, I said, what is the deal with these? And they said, well, he's enjoying this sort of post-mortem popularity. And I said, why? Because he utterly rejected the United States and he utterly rejected Israel and he paid the ultimate price for it. And he's a true Arab hero. That was my answer. And you get a sense that, I mean, I saw placards saying no to the gas from the occupation. In other words, there were Jordanians who were expressing this sentiment that they would rather not be able to heat their homes, not be able to heat up their, cook the food for their families if it meant that they had to accept gas from Israel. So one gets a sense that this is the ultimate crux of the problem. The question, though, is why King Abdullah wishes to message to the Palestinians that he's willing to go along with this narrative. He knows full well that Jordan needs Israel, that it needs the United States, that it needs this new regional structure that is taking place if Jordan is to survive. The challenges are only mounting, particularly as the United States looks to exit the Middle East, looks to engage in great power competition with China and Russia, et cetera. So Jordan has some tough choices ahead of itself. I think the United States and Israel have some tough choices too about how to entice Jordan to get back into the place that it was before the peace turned cold. And I believe that countries like the UAE and Bahrain and Morocco and Egypt all have a role to play as well, that if there is a new regional order that is to take place, they need to advocate for it. They cannot just simply enjoy the fruits of it, that they really do need to think about pushing Jordan in the right direction. Similarly, Saudi Arabia, I think, even as it has not made peace with Israel, it can demonstrate ways that you can, you know, not agree with Israel, but still work with Israel in ways that help to benefit the region. But at the end of the day, I can only stress that Jordan is the country that has the greatest choices to make. It's not that Israel is perfect in every way. It's not that Israel doesn't do things that might upset Jordan. The question is, why engage in this kind of acerbic rhetoric? Why place the tension out there in public for all to see when Jordan needs Israel desperately for all of the reasons that I described, and yet we continue to see them act publicly like enemies and we're watching that piece fray. It's not destroyed. It's not gone. But I believe that Jordan is playing with fire. And I also believe that Israel is growing frustrated and it will not get any better with Bibi Netanyahu coming to the helm. So I'll end there. And I'm very happy to answer any questions that you have, Shoshana, or any other questions from the group.
We have questions. First, I would point out, however, that you mentioned Jordan did not come to the Abraham Accords signing ceremony, but it did have a pilot in the US-led blue flag exercises with Israel last summer. So it really plays back and forth. They said it was a rumor that Jordan had a representative there watching the exercise, but in fact, it was a pilot, and the pilot was flying with blue flag countries, including Israel. So
there's
blue flag,
there's red flag. There are things that are happening, and they continue to happen. And again, that military intelligence, water, gas, those things are all happening. And at the same time, you know, you've got the Jordanians basically accusing Israel of, you know, the most horrific things during an outbreak of war with a terrorist organization that, by the way, Jordan rejects.
Yeah. So on the probably the most explosive subject for the day, I shouldn't use that word if we're talking about terrorists. Khaled Abu Tamer wrote yesterday, the most important thing for Jordan is to ensure that the Hashemite custodian ship over the Islamic and Christian holy sites in Jerusalem not be undermined. The custodianship is crucial for the Jordanian monarch and royalty because they believe it bolsters their political and religious standing. End quote. Is the king of Jordan really that worried about being overthrown? I mean, he is, after all, a descendant of Mohammed. Does he need this to stay in power? Does he believe he needs this not to be overthrown?
I don't know if he needs this to not be overthrown. Look, he's got problems.
Does he think he does?
I can't get inside his mind. What I can say is that there was this purported, it was not a serious coup plot, but this was his half-brother Hamza several years ago that was reported to have been trying to undermine him, and that was exposed and he was taken care of. There are perennial problems on the streets with opposition groups, human rights groups, Islamist groups, that come out into the streets. Generally, they're opposed to the economic policies of the kingdom, which, by the way, may not be changeable given the inherent challenges that Jordan faces. There are some political issues that come up here and there. I don't believe that the king is threatened by this. I do think that the Temple Mount, the Jerusalem custodianship issue, is one that does bestow upon the king a certain amount of legitimacy. That this is, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is still considered to be the third holiest site in Islam. The problem, in my view, is that this policy of utter antagonism toward Israel will ultimately push the Israelis to find another custodian. In other words, why do you want to continue to work with Jordan when they are hammering Israel at every turn? There have been rumors that the Israelis would potentially offer the Saudis that role if peace was made. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, and I don't know if it's in Israel's interest at the end of the day to do something like that, given the importance of Jordan as a buffer on Israel's eastern border. I believe that Israel needs Jordan as much as Jordan needs Israel. But the idea that Jordan feels that it can continue to engage in this kind of antagonistic relationship when it wants this, when it needs this role, is one of the things that I find very curious. You'd think that they would quietly try to figure out ways to solve problems rather than to lock horns publicly when at the end of the day, Jerusalem is sovereign Israeli soil, right? Jordan does not have the power to control it. It only is in Israel's power, and Israel can decide whether it wants to agree with Jordan or not. And that seems to be lost on this king at every moment of these disagreements.
So you would have to think then that the king is pushed by his fear of bad things that could happen to him. So he cooperates with Israel on the things that keep him on the throne. He says nasty things about Israel to mollify some of these people or mollify some of those people. So someone asked us, what is the possibility that Jordan is Palestine, and that the answer to the question is not the king. The answer to the question is Palestinians governing Jordan as Palestine.
Look, it's not something that Jordan wants. It's something that clearly some in Israel want. And I think, you know, we know who those people are in general. These are people of the Israeli right. What I find so interesting, though, is for a country that continues to reject the notion that Jordan is Palestine, they are stronger, more strident advocates for the Palestinian cause than the Palestinians themselves, right? They are by far the most vociferous voice for the two-state solution right now, and advocates for the Palestinians, particularly of the West Bank. You'd think that for a country that does not want to be Palestine, that perhaps they would take foreign policy, particularly their bilateral relations with Israel, and focus on something else entirely. Really, kind of unplug themselves from the morass of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. That would seem like the most logical foreign policy. But instead, right now, the king has become essentially the Palestinians' greatest advocate on the world stage, which would make him a Palestinian leader in some shape or form, not to mention the fact that his wife is Palestinian.
Okay. All right. If you talk about a two-state solution, most people talk about the West Bank and Gaza being one state and Israel being the other state. And somehow Jordan escapes responsibility for everything. Jordan was, of course, the Arab homeland envisioned by the British Mandate, and that's how they drew it. And yet somehow Jordan has managed to be both an advocate for the Palestinians and also not the Palestinians. How did Jordan escape this? Is that U.S.? I mean, I think that's a U.S. failure, by the way, as much as anything else.
It is. Maybe it's not a failure. It may be a feature, not a bug, as they say. Okay. All I can talk about is you know, we could debate history, but I think it's important to look at the current status of Jordan and how it is treated by the U.S. And I do mention this in the report. Jordan is widely viewed in Washington as being too weak to fail. There is no interest in holding Jordan to account for some of these sort of double standards or for some of its rhetoric or for any of its actions when I think it goes past a certain line. The Pentagon is perhaps Jordan's greatest advocate, right? The military cooperation, the importance that Jordan holds for the U.S. presence in the region. I always talk about, there's a description of what Iran is doing, right? They call it the Shiite Crescent, where you've got this radical presence that stretches from Iran to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon. Well, you have this sort of pragmatic crescent, if you will, that stretches from, Israel through Jordan into Saudi Arabia. And this is kind of the U.S. counter, if you will. This is the crescent under the crescent. Jordan plays an important role there. The State Department loves Jordan. And this comes despite the fact that Jordan is not liberal. Jordan is not a democracy. Jordan is not kind of part of that freedom agenda. It's got its own problems, not unlike every other monarchy or even some of the Arab republics. Now, it's nowhere near that kind of repressive apparatus of a Syria, for example, or in Egypt, but it's got its problems. But this, the State Department, the Pentagon, the White House will not mess with that. And by the way, Israel doesn't want to either, right? At the end of the day, the goal for Jordan is to be this buffer between Israel and the West. And they stand kind of right at the forefront against a lot of the radical things that we see further east. And that has long been Jordan's role. That bulwark against radicalism is still seen as something that is incredibly important. And by the way, we're not wrong to look at it that way. I think where we're wrong is to not hold Jordan accountable for the mistakes that it makes, for the rhetoric that it engages in, for antagonizing Israel, for airing dirty laundry, for overstepping its bounds on Jerusalem or on Palestinian issues. I think what the goal should be right now is to push Jordan into that Abraham Accord structure. Ideally, they would go willingly. But really, when you look at the leverage that the Emiratis and the Saudis and the Israelis have, they have everything that Jordan needs in order to survive. Without them, Jordan is in a lot of trouble. And I think that does need to be stressed.
So you said the magic words leading to the next inflammatory question. Holding Jordan accountable. One of the things that people want to hold Jordan accountable for, some people do, many people do, I do, want to hold Jordan accountable for, is the fact that Ahlam Tamimi, the self-confessed, self-promoting terrorist who killed a young American girl in the Sparrow Pizza bombing in Jerusalem, is both on the FBI's most wanted terrorist list and living the high life in Amman. Periodically, the United States makes an overture to get her here because Malki Roth was an American citizen, and that comes with certain obligations by our government. And they are consistently rejected. How do we deal with that? First of all, I know that you've got more information about this, so I would ask you to enlighten us a little bit on the situation and the specific legal position of Tamimi, and then ask the question, should we be pressuring them? We do have everything they want. We do have everything they need. Can we get her back?
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, just say my heart goes out to the Roth family. A horrific story and just a terrible experience that no family should have to go through. My understanding in speaking to Israelis and Jordanians is that, first of all, Israel released her willingly as a result of the Gilad Shalit trade. That trade, by the way, was a terrible one in my view. It released, you know, more than 1,000 Hamas and other terrorist activists, some of whom are recidivists, right? They've gone back to the fighting. They've gone back to the financing of terrorism, right? I mean, this is I think predictable, but very sad. And so Israel has sort of relinquished its rights here, right? It doesn't have a dog in this fight any longer. It's hard for Israel to say that anything further can or should be done. From Jordan's perspective, what they say is, according to their laws, she has already served time in an Israeli prison, and that she was released as part of a legal deal that essentially exonerates Jordan from having to do anything further. I will say that, well, and I'm not a lawyer and I don't know how to interpret Jordanian law, but even if that is the case, the idea that she would be living the high life and have a sort of a massive social media presence and be something of a celebrity in Jordan is outrageous and should not be tolerated by the United States or any of Jordan's allies. And then comes the final question, which is, you know, on the US side, right? If she's on our most wanted list, then that's clearly a sign that our legal experts in Washington have determined that she is someone that can be extradited. We have a treaty with the Jordanians, so therefore it's something that is feasible. So then it becomes a question of political will. We didn't see that change during the Trump years. I don't suspect we're going to see that change during the Biden years. I think we're going to see a standoff. Again, I think largely because of that too weak to fail mentality that Jordan needs to be handled with kid gloves. I'd be curious to get the State Department on record now, in light of, you know, sort of some of what we've been seeing out of Jordan, that change in rhetoric over the last couple of years. But my guess is that they would probably just as soon appease than pressure.
So you mentioned again, Jordan being too weak to fail, too vulnerable to fail. We have interests in Jordan that require that we shore it up, which I agree with. However, we can't necessarily make that determination. What if it falls? It's always a possibility. We never thought the Shah was going to fall. Regardless of what we did, we thought he would be there forever. What if he falls? Do you believe that Israel has a plan B to deal with it, that the United States has a plan B to deal with a monarch overthrow? And most importantly, maybe that Iran would benefit in ways that will really be detrimental to Israel and to the United States if it happens.
Look, I believe that Iran has its eyes on Jordan. I don't believe that Iran is actively working and has a, 10-step plan to do this. But again, with the Captagon problem that apparently is growing inside Jordan, that is very much linked back to Iranian militias and to the Assad regime, the Shiite militias that are destabilizing the border, the naval problems to the south, we can see that Iran feels comfortable destabilizing, right? Engaging in malign activity that might weaken the state in some shape or form. As for the plan B, I can only say that our State Department doesn't have a plan for when Mahmoud Abbas goes in the West Bank. If we don't have a plan for that, and the guy's 80 something years old, and is barely able to keep his head up during meetings with U.S. officials. This is a guy who has been in power since 2005. We're not talking about a particularly organized State Department here as it relates to succession. And I think that when it comes to Jordan, it's even more sensitive, right? That we don't want to talk about succession. We don't want to. By the way, I don't want to. I mean, at the end of the day, I would like to see the Hashemite kingdom stay in power and then just simply recalibrate its policies, right? Start to downplay all these maximalist Palestinian demands that put pressure on the regime, and to steer the country toward greater integration with Israel and the Abraham Accords countries, and to forge that new path. Right. I mean, everywhere I go around the region right now, people are talking about stability and prosperity. This should be the focus for Jordan as well. Instead, what we find them focusing on is like the old Palestinian narrative. I mean, it almost feels, when you walk into certain offices in Amman, it almost feels like you're back in the 80s or the 70s, right? Kind of the height of rejectionism of Israel. It was not a model for success. It was not a model for stability. It was not a model for prosperity. So my hope is that the Jordanian regime understands this and begins to make changes that don't necessitate and don't prompt, some of the tumult that I think you're implying. That would not be a positive outcome, I think, at least in my view.
So I had the honor of meeting King Abdullah 3 weeks after he took over the throne in Jordan. And as you know, he wasn't planning on it. He had not been raised to it. He had not been raised to believe that he would be the king. And 3 weeks in as king, I took a group of American military officers to Amman and we met with him. And I have to say that the difference between then and now is extraordinary. I mean, he was full of kind of Western optimism and optimism for the West and optimism for things that the West could do. And that included Israel. And then all of that disappeared over time. So this leads to a question that someone has sent in to us. Things change. Abdullah has changed clearly, but he was in charge, is in charge, and if we're lucky, perhaps will remain in charge. Israel has had a government that went from Bibi to others to Bibi, and now it's Bibi. So the question is it possible that the new Netanyahu government will take a different attitude toward Jordan, perhaps one that's not as, accommodating, not as willing to see Jordan as the vulnerable victim, but instead as part of the problem? What do you think is going to happen between the Israelis and the Jordanians at a government level?
It's a good question. It's dangerous in our business to try to predict things, but I'll do my best with my crystal ball. I would say that if things continue to get worse, if they deteriorate in the West Bank, Jordan and Israel will have a pretty tough go. Because there is, at least under the current circumstances, it does not appear that the king is going to be willing to step back from the brink and to curb some of this rhetoric. I think we're only going to see that rhetoric sharpen over time. As long as Jerusalem is a problem, next Ramadan will be a problem. As I mentioned, I don't need a crystal ball for that. It's scheduled. Right. So we're going to see that happen. If there is a conflict with Hamas, if there is a conflict with West Bank militants, it is going to get worse before it gets better. And so, you know, that's the thing that I worry about. On the other side of the coin here is this question of Saudi, right? If Saudi goes in the direction of the Abraham Accords, which is, of course, where everybody's watching right now, we are all eager to see whether Saudi takes this step. And I don't think it happens in the next 2 years. I don't believe that the Saudis will give the Biden administration the Nobel Prize. I can't imagine that happens. But, you know, let's say over the next 2 years, the steps are taken and then eventually the Saudis take that step. I think it changes everything. I think the entire tone and tenor of the region as it relates to Israel, you can't be holier than the Pope, so to speak. The Saudis are, you know, the leaders of the Arab world, the custodians of the two holy places. If they are willing to go there, then it could mean change everywhere else. It would take the wind out of the sails of the Palestinian movement. The other thing that I would just keep an eye out for is new Palestinian leadership. At some point, I don't know when, but Mahmoud Abbas will not be able to govern any longer. Not that he's governing a whole lot right now, should he leave the scene, there could be a new leader. And that is, you know, that can also cut both ways. You could have utter chaos in a battle for control, or you could see somebody take over that finally puts some structure to the leadership and really begins to work to build infrastructure in the West Bank and coordinates with Jordan. So we're watching all of these sort of permutations and possibilities. There's a lot of danger. There is some opportunity. But again, I think a lot of this does rest on the shoulders of the Hashemite kingdom itself. I think the king can steer things in a different direction. He doesn't have to agree with everything that Israel does. You don't have to love Itamar Ben-Gvir. You don't have to love Bibi. But there is infrastructure in place to handle such issues quietly and to address them behind closed doors and to present a united front or a semi-united front. This should be the goal of two countries that need each other very much and with a relationship that is still brokered by the United States, which sees this relationship as crucial to the projection of its interests and its power around the region.
So we've come to the end of our program. And as listeners know, I like to go out on an optimistic note. You've given us not an optimistic note, but a balanced note. It could go downhill. It could go uphill. It could be, if you were a betting man, and I have no idea whether you are or not, but if you were a betting man, where would you put your nickels?
I would put my nickels on things continuing as they are. In other words, all things equal, the peace holds, all right? The frustration will build on both the Israeli side because of the rhetoric, on the Jordanian side because of perceived Israeli actions on, you know, the Temple Mount or elsewhere. I think things will hold. My problem or my concern is that it's hard to imagine them holding with the rhetoric and the sort of tone of everything being what it is. This can last another 2 years or 5 years. Something's going to have to give. And my hope, you want to go to a positive, my hope here is that the Abraham Accords broadens, right? That Israel under Bibi or under somebody else continues to find new peace partners. And eventually Jordan feels that has no choice but to join this structure that it has rejected up until now. The moment that it does that is the moment that I think, you know, Israeli-Jordanian relations align in the way that they should and perhaps the way that they always should have.
I will take that as an optimistic ending to our program today. Jonathan Shanzer, thank you very much. You've enlightened us. You've upset us a little bit, but that's probably good for us. So thank you, and I hope we'll see you again. To everyone else, we'll see you soon.